Welcome to episode 427 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Dr. Rune Talsnes, who is a postdoctoral fellow at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. And in this interview, we discuss overtraining, training progression and periodization, and some general topics within endurance training, in particular, some insights from the world of cross-country skiing. But before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. Precision Fuel and Hydration help athletes personalize their hydration and fueling strategies for training and racing. You can use their free fuel and hydration planner to get a personalized plan for your carbohydrate, sodium, and fluid intake in your next event. And if you want even more help, why not book a free 20-minute video consultation to chat for your plan with the athlete support team? As a TTS listener, you can get 15% off your first order of Precision Fuel and Hydration products by using the code TTS24 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Indoor Swim Trainer allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. You can target specific aspects of your stroke, like your catch and pull through, and work on technique and power. The design of the bench forces you to constantly work on core activation, which can help your body position in the water. And most importantly, you can stay consistent in your training even when you don't have time to go to the pool for a full swimming session. You can try the Senate risk-free for 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senatesimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's the interview with Dr. Rune Talsnes. Welcome to the Triathlon Show, Rune. How are you doing?
Thank you. I'm doing fine.
Tell us a little bit more about yourself. First of all, who are you and where are you calling in from?
Yeah. No, my name is Rune Talsnes. Living in Trondheim, in the middle of Norway. At the moment, I'm a researcher or a postdoctoral fellow at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology and the Center for Elite Sport Research in Trondheim. And I also work as an exercise physiologist at Olympiatoppen, or the top sports center in Trondheim, with the physiological testing of endurance athletes and mostly cross-country skiers.
All right. So I have looked at your research that you have conducted and looked into a few different themes that we're going to talk about. And the one that I want to start with is overtraining. Let's start with just you have an interesting case study on the topic that I'll link to in the show notes, but I don't want to ask so much exactly from the research paper, but let you talk more freely about overtraining and your experience both in the pure academic sense, but also maybe if you've been in applied science. Can you describe a bit more your experience and your insights into overtraining that you might have?
Yeah, it's broad question, but from doing my research, mostly I focused on endurance training and how to optimize adaptations and performance, I kind of changed direction more towards negative training outcomes and non-functional athletes and endurance athletes in particular. And these questions related to overreaching, overtraining. And it started with the case study that you mentioned that we published last year on a Norwegian world-class male cross-country skier that experienced two seasons of unexpected underperformance related to maybe overtraining or REDS, relative energy deficiency in sports. And we did a project on him with an interdisciplinary team, including experienced coach, me, professor here at NTNU, and also a master student that wrote his thesis on following this national team skier on his way back from experiencing underperformance to world-class level. And so that's kind of where it started, working on this topic for me. And now in my postdoctoral years or postdoctoral research, I'm moving more and more towards that topic on non-functional endurance athletes, overtraining, REDS, and also how this can be early identified and monitoring and this type of things. So that's kind of my background from now working more with this topic.
So let's maybe then get into what are some of the most common reasons that you see in practice and in the literature that that athletes run into overtraining or non-functional overreaching issues.
Yeah, that's a good and complex question. And it's if you look at literature and also in sports practice, there's a lot of different terminologies and concepts and words used to describe these states of athletes not functioning. So overreaching, overtraining syndrome, underperformance, unexplained underperformance, and REDS. There's a lot of different concepts, and how the literature defines it now, it's also maybe it's a bit questionable, a bit vague, the terminology and also the scientific evidence. But it's the literature today summarizes it in kind of fatigue adaptation continuum, ranging from acute fatigue that you typically experience following training overload, either by a session or some sessions. And then this continuum continues towards overreaching, which is then a state where you have a reduction in performance levels compared to your baseline level. And then you often have a recovery period following training overload. And if you kind of restore your performance level and also improve your performance, and you get a kind of training effect or training adaptation, then it's typically referred to as a functional overreaching. And on the other side, you also have non-functional overreaching, which is decreasing your performance compared to baseline. But following a period of reduced training load and recovery, you don't get kind of an overcompensation effect or improved adaptations and performance compared to baseline levels. And if this continues over time with insufficient recovery and too high training load, and maybe in combination with other kind of stress loads, it can manifest into an overtraining syndrome, which is suggested at least to be more rare and more severe and takes much longer time to recover from. So the time needed for performance restoration is longer compared to overreaching. And in many cases, this syndrome is also reason why athletes are quitting doing sports. They're not able to fully recover and go back to a good level, the level they were in before. And together with these changes in performance, it's also a lot of proposed physiological signs and symptoms that manifests together in overtraining syndrome and also in non-functional overreaching. And so this is how the literature defines it currently. It can probably be discussed if that's correct, but it's kind of the definitions today. And also in recent years, it's more and more emphasized on the fact that many kind of states of overtraining or overtraining syndrome, overreaching, might be explained by low energy availability, that the athletes, endurance athletes, which perform high training loads and high energy expenditures, don't have sufficient energy intake, and they come in state of low energy availability or low carbohydrate availability, and also maybe a diagnosis of REDS, relative energy deficiency in sport. So in many cases, previously, where athletes have been kind of diagnosed with overtraining, it might have been low energy ability and REDS. So this is also part of this picture on non-functional endurance athletes. And REDS can either come with or without kind of a disordered eating behavior or a clinical diagnosis of disordered or eating disorder. So that's kind of the definitions and how it's currently defining the literature, but it's at least when you look to overtraining syndrome, it's quite complex, multifactorial, and often training is not the main cause or the sole cause of this condition. It's often related to other stress loads in addition to training. I guess you can argue that it could also be termed kind of an under-recovery state, under-recovery syndrome, or another term that is often used is unexplained underperformance syndrome, which I think is might be better because it's not solely caused by overtraining, but also other factors. So maybe unexplained underperformance syndrome is better than overtraining syndrome, but overtraining or high training load is probably a part of the picture, but it's not the only cause of this type of states.
Right. So, if we talk about that case study as an example, what were the reasons that you identified for why this national team athlete went into a state of underperformance and I guess overtraining?
Yeah. As it's as the term says, it's kind of underperformance. So for that particular athlete, it was changes in his performance level, variations in performance level, and kind of underperformance in competitions, both nationally and in the World Cup. And it was also associated with some other signs and symptoms of too high load compared to recovery. But it took some time before he really took these signs kind of seriously and were ready to do some changes in the training and recovery process to make him return back to a more functional state and a better performance level again. So kind of it doesn't exist any single validated tool or test to diagnose someone with either overtraining or REDS, but kind of the sum of all kind of signs and symptoms and the underperformance and larger variations in performance indicated that he had reached such a state. And then the process of making him return back to a more functional state started.
So when that process started, and first of all, I think that that's an important point, that it took him some time to realize that the performance was declining. I think that's or maybe not realize the performance is declining, but I think it's natural as athletes sometimes we're not doing as well as we could, and then the tendency for athletes, for endurance athletes especially, because we're used to working hard, we like to work hard, the tendency is almost to try to train harder or train more to try to fix the problem. So it can be a double-edged sword almost in just making the problem worse. For this athlete, what were the things that changed in his process, because he did manage then return from that underperformance and race again at a really high level. So what were the changes that were made?
Yeah, that's a good point, which we probably also will come back to. To kind of, in your training, you need good control system to detect these type of stakes at an early phase and try to do adjustment to prevent it to becoming as severe as it became in this case. But after he kind of stopped competing in the second season he had with the unstable performances and underperformance, he had a period of recovery. So quite large reductions in training, and he didn't compete any longer. So the focus was on rest and recovery. And then at the same time with this team that I said, an analysis was done on kind of with the goal of trying to identify which kind of contributing factors that explain this state. So kind of medical, possible medical reasons, possible factors related to the training, other factors related to the recovery and nutrition. So kind of a detailed analysis of his kind of training and development process were done, where different kind of possible contributing factors to this state were identified. So that was kind of the first step in the process. And then the second step was kind of try to do interventions or changes in his training, recovery, and nutrition to that targeted these contributing factors. That was like kind of the second step. And the third step was to have a better system for monitoring and quality assurance and decision support in this process of returning to a more functional state. So kind of three-step process, where we first have to do an analysis of what are the contributing factors to this state. Two, do interventions that are targeting these contributing factors. And three, have a system to quality ensure and monitor the process of coming back to a more functional state. That was kind of the how the process were done. And the details of that can be found in the case study, but there were changes in his training process. For example, some changes in intensity control during sessions. He stopped doing these double threshold sessions, kind of two threshold interval sessions in one day. He also stopped doing these long, low-intensity sessions with low carbohydrate availability. And there were also some changes in his nutrition, excluding all methods of training with low carbohydrate ability, which he did the 2 years he didn't perform that well. And there were also some, as I said, introduced better systems for monitoring and quality assurance of the process, and also better follow-up maybe in his daily training with the assistant coach, which was also the master's student that wrote his thesis on this project. So that was kind of, briefly described the changes that were done, but the details can probably be found in the paper.
Yeah, but I think that gives a good good summary of some of the main points there. With the monitoring, I would just want to follow up a bit more. So basically, he ended up working more closely, giving feedback to this assistant coach from his day-to-day training, or what was the role of the assistant coach in this case?
Yeah, the role of the assistant coach was to follow him up on a daily basis and contribute in daily training sessions to have the highest possible quality on those sessions. And for example, blood lactate tests during sessions, video during sessions, working on technique and different technical assignments. And basically follow up and make sure that the right things were done, and reducing the risk of doing any errors in the training, and supporting the process to obtain the highest possible quality.
Yeah, and one thing as well that I seem to remember that was mentioned in the case study was about reducing training monotony, or including some more periodization of the microcycles or mesocycles. So can you explain a bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. That was one of the changes in the training, introduction of more periodization and week-to-week periodization or micro periodization. So typically followed he followed like 2-to-1 periodization model, I would say. So 2 weeks with relatively high training load, and followed by 1 week of reduced training load or recovery. And the 2 weeks with high training load were also kind of one of them with a moderate training load, and the second week with a high training load. So it was kind of a yellow and a red week, followed by a recovery week or a green week with quite clear reduction in training load. So in the beginning, he started with maybe 15 hours per week in the week with the moderate load, and then 20 hours in the week with high load, followed by 10 hours in the week with the reduced load or recovery, and then up to 20 and 25 hours in the moderate and high load week, and then 15 hours in the recovery week. And then the recovery week were maintained with 15 hours. And in the periods with high strain load, it was 25 hours and 30 hours in the two high load weeks, followed by 15 hours in the recovery week. So that was kind of the periodization or differences in load.
In terms of, this might be more general or related to the follow-up from the case study perhaps, but you discussed monitoring. How do you potentially detect signals early enough that you can prevent an athlete or prevent yourself from getting into a state of severe underperformance? What do we know, what can we hypothesize about monitoring strategies for not getting into situations like this?
No, but as I said, I think it's important to have kind of good control systems, both as an individual athlete, but also as a team or a group of athletes. And I think we can see that those athletes and teams that are performing well, they have this kind of systems, both to do adjustments in the training and to maximize adaptations and performance development, but also at the same time reduce the risk of kind of overreaching or overtraining in these type of states and in an earlier phase. And this can be different things. And I think in combination of kind of subjective and objective tools or tests could be beneficial. And you often I separate it into kind of the daily measures. And there you have kind of resting heart rate variability as objective measures. And as subjective measures, you kind of have more perceived fatigue, muscle soreness, readiness to train or compete. This type of questionnaires, profile of mood state, there's a lot of things to choose between. And I think that is good on a daily basis, in addition to kind of record all the training data. And in addition, I think it's good to have kind of the, we often see that athletes and teams or groups that are performing well, they often have kind of standardized training sessions or physiological profiling at submaximal intensities, typically a blood lactate profile or something, every 3 to 4 week or something like that, where they kind of use the relationship between external and internal intensity and how that changes to kind of see if the athlete is adapting to the training or not, and being able to do adjustments in the training in an early phase. So this works as a control system and a decision supportive system. So typically in Norway, many endurance athletes and cross country skiers, they have a blood lactate profile either in running or roller skiing at kind of a constant workload or increasing workload, where they measure heart rate, blood lactate, rate of perceived exhaustion or something. For example, at the constant incline, 4 or 5 minute stages and increasing speed progressively. And then if you have kind of really low blood lactate or heart rate at a given submaximal speed, it might be an indicator of fatigue, for example. And often if that is in combination with increased rating of perceived exhaustion, then it's a warning sign, kind of an indicator of something. And so I think that is kind of the subjective and objective tests or tools that is nice to use in a monitoring context. At the same time, I don't think you should underestimate the value of the coach that are present in daily training and have a good coach athlete relationship and the coach present and being able to observe these different signs and symptoms at an early stage. So they can see it in the eyes kind of on the athletes that they are tired or that something is wrong. And if they eat breakfast together with him, they can see if there's any changes there. So if the athlete is kind of looking really tired and have his head down in the breakfast table or something, then it's kind of an indicator that you need to do some changes. So in my experience, the most successful coaches are able to integrate information both from objective tests and training diaries, but also by the relationship with the athlete. So I think yes. It's really important to emphasize, and often that is undervalued, especially today when you have all these fancy monitoring tools and systems that can help you.
Yeah, yeah. And I listened to an interview with a very good triathlon coach who was talking about this a little bit, and how you in the interactions with an athlete can kind of use those interactions to see how they're doing, whether they are fatigued, and he just made the point that for most athletes that's really valuable, but there are some athletes, like rare exceptions, but some of them that you don't see any changes in mood, and those are the hardest athletes to work with, because no matter how fatigued they are still as cheerful and as happy and have the same humor and mood and everything. And for most that's not the case, so you can kind of tell in interactions, but with some athletes those were the ones that he said that they are the hardest to coach, because you can't read the interactions in the same way as you do with most athletes, and how that correlates to fatigue from training and so on. So that was just an interesting side note. But then the other thing that I wanted to highlight that you said there with the submaximal test, I think that's really great. And I would say even that you can do it, you mentioned using lactate, heart rate, and RPE, and then you have a fixed protocol, fixed workload, which is fantastic. But for most listeners, I would say even if you don't use lactate, I don't think you need to do that. Even if you have a fixed workout session that you, it might be a bike ride on the trainer where you can control things really well, and you just measure heart rate and RPE for certain stages, like a progressive step test, like a lactate test, but without the lactate itself, then you can already tell a lot. For example, as you said, if heart rate is unusually low and RPE is a bit higher than normal, then that already tells you a lot about your performance readiness and your state of fatigue, even without the lactate data, in my experience.
Definitely. That's a really, really good point. And many athletes also do that. They don't have lactate measurement devices, and it's also difficult to do good lactate measurements on yourself kind of during a test. So if you have a protocol with either cycling at different power outputs or running at increasing speeds or something, and you measure rating of perceived exhaustion and heart rate, that can give you a lot of information that can be used to detect either adaptations and improvements or kind of fatigue or something.
Yeah. We had a couple of listener questions on this topic over training, so I'll bring them in now. The first one is about blood markers to determine overtraining. Is that something that you're familiar with?
I've read a lot of the literature on kind of overreaching, overtraining, in different blood markers or biomarkers that are available and used in the literature, but in the way I interpret it, there's no kind of consensus on that. And as I said earlier, it doesn't exist any single validated test or blood test that can diagnose you with overreaching or overtraining. So on the other hand, I kind of see the relevance of measuring it. If you have kind of testosterone, cortisol, and the ratio between those two, there might be relevance of including that if you have the possibility. Many kind of national teams and so they do that. And also you have several studies from the group of Meusen that have done a lot of work on overreaching and overtraining. They've also developed and introduce this two-bout exercise protocol that you perform two maximal exercise tests in one day with 4 hours of recovery in between. And in the second exercise test, they have seen kind of a reduced response in some of the HPA axis-related hormones, or the pituitary hormones named prolactin and ACTH, which is two hormones in the brain in the second test. And athletes that are kind of diagnosed with overtraining have had that response, but the athletes with overreaching have had a kind of a normal response in these two pituitary hormones. So I don't think those studies come without limitations, but there might be something there, definitely. They have done a lot of good work on that. So that's kind of...
Probably hard to implement in practice, though. There are not a lot of...
Definitely. So in a monitoring context, to detect overreaching in an early phase, you kind of need other tests, I would say. And this is more tests for, suggested to diagnose someone with an overtraining syndrome and looking more at the mechanisms. But on a month-to-month basis in a monitoring context, I think it's not relevant to use this type of test. So, there are some blood markers that are relevant to overtraining and overtraining syndrome, but there's no kind of clear consensus today. I think, shouldn't put too much emphasis on that. But if you had a possibility, it could be nice to include some blood markers, both for reds and kind of training stress in endurance athletes.
So if you did that, you mentioned testosterone and cortisol, and let's say you not within the exercise test context that we talked about, but you just go to the lab and you take blood, draw blood, and you ask them to analyze it. What should you ask for anything else other than testosterone and cortisol in that context?
I'm not any expert on this, and not a medical doctor, and don't have the kind of knowledge to really provide a really good answer on this. But I think, and many also uses that, it's kind of indicators of low energy ability and REDS. So that could be kind of cholesterol, T3 hormones, leptin. These kind of markers that are relevant for detecting low energy ability and REDS in combination with, for example, measurements on bone mineral density using DEXA scans. And so that could be relevant to include in a monitoring context on kind of elite level endurance athletes if you have the resources and the competence in your support team to use those markers in a good way.
Got it. And the same person also asks about trends with athletes on antidepressants after a period of overtraining. Does it help? And I must say, this is something that I have never heard of. So I didn't quite understand the question, but maybe you have.
I don't have any expertise with that, and don't have kind of the competence or education to say something about that. But I read it in literature on overtraining as a kind of hypothesis that might have some potential benefits with regards to an overtraining syndrome, but I've never seen any data on kind of the actual effects of it. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Yep. And then the final listener question on overtraining was, I think we maybe answered it, but it's about how to differentiate quote-unquote massive overreaching from overtraining syndrome. And I guess if I understood your explanation correctly, it's more of a spectrum and there's not a specific point of this is overtraining, this is overreaching, but it's on a spectrum. But maybe you can clarify that again.
No, but that is correct. It's kind of a spectrum ranging from overreaching to overtraining syndrome, and there's no kind of good way to differentiate that prospectively. So often a final diagnosis must be, or at least is suggested to be made in retrospect, and based on the time needed for recovery and performance restoration. So if you have weeks to maybe a month or two in the process of restoring your performance levels, then it's maybe overreaching. But if it's month to years, then it's probably more the overtraining syndrome. So I would say it's at least how it's described in the literature now. It's based on the time needed for performance restoration. But also this two-bout exercise protocol developed by Mewson and colleagues with the HPA related hormones is also suggested to be able to differentiate between non-functional overreaching and overtraining syndrome.
Yep. All right. So let's move on to the second topic, which is this was part of your PhD research, where basically some periodization studies. So I'll let you introduce it and you will explain it better than I did. And so can you talk about this research project that you did, and then we go into some discussions about it.
Yeah, I can try to summarize those two articles in a brief manner. But before I started working more on this non-functional athlete, I had more emphasis on endurance training in general and cross-country skiing training in particular. And as a part of my PhD, we did a training intervention study on junior cross-country skiers in mid-Norway. And I think it was almost 50 skiers that following an 8-week baseline period with the same training and training intensity distribution, they were randomly allocated into two different interventions groups. So one, increasing their training load by increasing the volume of low intensity training, and the other group increasing their training load by intensification or by increasing the volume of high intensity training. And this kind of increase in training load were matched by TRIMP score. So it was a match for training load. They had the same kind of, at least on average, the same increase in training load, but two different training models or intensity distributions. So maybe one of them were more in the pyramidal kind of side, and the other intensity distribution were more in the polarized side of the intensity distribution. So that was kind of an 8-week intervention. And we had tests both before and after in the lab, measuring performance variables in running and roller skiing together with the physiological measurements, both at maximal intensities and also incremental tests to exhaustion, measuring with peak. And we also had a running time trial in the field. And after this 8-week intervention period, we included a 5-week period of standardized training with the same kind of training intensity distribution for both groups. So after having this 8-week period with different intensity distribution, they had a 5-week period of the same training intensity distribution. And in summary, what we saw was that after the 8-week intervention with two different focuses on intensity, both groups improved their performance compared to baseline, both in the upper running time trial in the field, but also some performance measures in the lab. And there were no significant changes or no significant differences in change between the two groups. However, the group that had a more increase in high intensity training or emphasized high intensity training, they had an increase in their V2 peak, which was significantly different from a non-change in the peak for the low-intensity group. So although there were no significant differences in performance changes, there were a difference in the change in VO2 peak after the 8-week intervention. But after the 5-week subsequent training period with the same intensity distribution, there were no differences between the two groups in improvements in performance or VO2 peak. So kind of the physiological benefits or effects on VO2 peak that the high intensity group achieved during the intervention period were kind of outbalanced in the 5 weeks subsequent training period, when the low intensity group also had some more high intensity training, but not the same volume as the high intensity group had in the intervention. So that's kind of, yeah, briefly what we did. So we're looking at two different ways to progress your training load, either by high intensity or low intensity, and it was matched in kind of a more ecologically valid manner, we would say. And we also included the subsequent training period to look more at the subsequent or long-term effects of intensification in a typical training intervention.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very interesting design, and especially the fact that you did look at, okay, what happens 5 weeks later. So I think you talked about in the papers about how it was a bit of a simulation of first a general preparation period, the 8 week intervention, and then more of a specific preparation period, the 5 week period. And so you wanted to see, okay, if the general preparation contains more intensification versus more volume overload, does that then impact the results you will get once you get to the end of your specific preparation period? So a very realistic and common question that any athlete or coach will face in their own training: how do you periodize things? But in the end, there weren't so many differences to speak about there, which in itself is a very interesting finding, and I guess maybe speaks to a big takeaway that load is maybe the most important variable after all, or at least from looking at your studies. But what do you think are the takeaways that you draw from this work?
No, but I think that's a good summary, and I think what we see here is that different models might work, different kind of training intensity distribution models, but also ways to periodize this intensity distribution. So different periodization models might work. So maybe it's the factors driving adaptations and performance is more related to load and kind of finding the correct load recovery balance. And also, of course, how you perform this training might have an influence on your adaptations and performance improvements. So kind of the quality in your daily training and how you perform these sessions is of importance. And another kind of take home is that the emphasis on high intensity training, HIIT sessions have kind of quite rapid increase on VO2 peak. And it doesn't take many weeks to kind of maximize the effects of intensification, but after that it kind of levels off. So if you are kind of in your specific preparation and the competition period is approaching, you might not need a long time with more emphasis on high intensity training and speed to kind of maximize your adaptations and be ready for competitions. So, yeah, that's some of the take homes from those studies, and also I think, or at least one of the reasons why we did it was also related to methodology. That many kind of short term training intervention studies, they show a favor of high intensity training, but they haven't necessarily matched high intensity training with low intensity training in an ecologically valid manner. It kind of used a matching based on energy expenditure or oxygen uptake during sessions. But at low intensity, you can do much more work to reach the same training load as you do with high intensity training. So I think it's one of few training intervention studies that kind of shows an effect, at least on performance changes of kind of volume and low emphasis and low intensity training, which as practitioners we often see, but it's no kind of experimental training intervention studies that have shown that.
Important to point out that it wasn't that both groups improved. There was no difference between groups, but both groups improved through this 8-week intervention, their performance. So the volume overload worked well. Did you have, what about, let's call them responders, non-responders? Was there a lot of individual variation within the groups? Because now we're talking about group averages, of course, but when you look at the individual data, did you see anything interesting there?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Now we refer to kind of mean changes and what can be expected on average if you do this. But there were also individual variations in adaptations. And there were, for example, athletes in the low-intensity group that improved their VO2 peak after low-intensity training focus to the same extent as some in the high-intensity group, kind of, and vice versa. And I think it's important in training intervention studies to kind of show these individual variations, and we try to do that as well, and kind of classify them into, I think it was low, moderate, and high responses. So definitely there were individual variations. And this concept about responders and individual variations to training is kind of discussed and has some methodological complexities. So it's hard to say what is explaining here. And maybe those that didn't get the same response or adaptations, they had too low training load, or maybe they had too high training load, or there were other kind of stress loads that contributed to their low response. So, and also if you replicate the study and perform the same intervention again, there might be changes in these individual responses. So maybe some of them that showed like a low response would have a moderate or even high response if you do it again. So to be kind of really good scientific evidence, you probably need to replicate the same study again and get the same kind of responses individually. So there are some methodological issues related to that. And of course, each individual athlete is unique and have their own life and all these different factors in their training and recovery and life in general that possibly contribute to variations in individual, contributes to individual variations in adaptations obtained by the different training models.
Yep, absolutely. Are there any other takeaways that you would say, and other conclusions from this work, or things that listeners should be aware of in your opinion?
No, I think we covered the most important aspects, I would say, of this work, about the kind of relevant take homes, but also kind of the limitations of especially looking at individual responses. So I think that covers pretty much those two articles.
All right. So let's move into some general questions here. And first of all, I want to ask about testing and in cross-country skiing and elite cross-country skiing specifically. You work with Olympiatoppen, as you said, so it's something that is part of your job. What does a testing battery look like for elite cross-country skiers, and is it just to monitor where they are, or is it very much used to influence training decisions? What sort of training athletes need to work on? Can you elaborate a bit on this discussion on testing?
Yeah. It's not a simple answer to that. I think it varies a bit across different teams, groups. And historically, it's also been some variations in the extent how testing is used, but there are long traditions in Norway and Olympiatoppen for kind of doing physiological testing in cross-country skiing. And a lot of tests have been done in running to kind of look at the general physiological capacities and maximum velocity and uptake. But over the last kind of 15 years, there's also been introduced more tests roller skiing on the kind of larger treadmills. So I would say, I don't say that everyone does this, but kind of in an optimal manner, I would say that they do or should do kind of 2 to 4 annual tests, including both some maximal stages or low lactate profile, and also incremental test to exhaustion or a V2 peak or V2 max test, to kind of look more at the different capacities that the athletes have, but also to look at how these capacities changes within an annual cycle and also between annual cycles, to kind of quality ensure the training and performance development, both at an individual level, but also at the group or team level. And if you have historically data on this, it kind of, the system provides a lot of relevant information. So I think I would say that that is best practice, and most athletes and teams should aim for that if they have the possibility. In addition, we also do some more kind of frequent tests, as I mentioned earlier, like some maximal tests or typically low lactate profiles, either in running or roller skiing on the large treadmill. Those tests are more used for kind of monitoring the response from training month to month, for example. So you have these standardized sessions or low lactate profiles every month, somehow, have at least. And those are used more for control sessions and decision support, and see if you kind of have adapted to the previous training period and that you are ready to a new training period. So I think it's kind of two aspects. One is the full package with the blood lactate profile in the max test to kind of look at the capacities and how these capacities change over time. And the other aspect is more these control sessions that you do more frequently to, yeah, you can also kind of say something about adaptations there as well, but it's also more to prevent athletes to become fatigued and kind of manifesting to this fatigue continuum with overreaching, I would say. So that is how it's, yeah, kind of at least the way some does it, and some maybe do a combination, or some maybe do the only the submaximal tests, but it's I think that gives a summary of how we think about it.
Yeah, and when you test with running, and or if you compare testing running and roller skiing on the treadmill, is the, for example, the VO2 peak values that you see, are they very similar, so that you can kind of use running interchangeably, or are there some athletes that are maybe not so good at running specifically, so that they struggle to get a VO2 peak that is representative of their true VO2 peak? Because, for example, in triathlon, you see that, let's say you have a strong athlete that is strong in swimming, biking, and running, their VO2 peak will be slightly higher in running than cycling, but they'll be very close. But if you have somebody that is, for example, a weaker cyclist or a weaker runner, then they will not reach the same VO2 max in that discipline. So is there that variation there, depending on I know that a lot of the skiers are really good runners, but I'm not sure if that applies to all of them. So do you see that as a problem, and it's better to do it on the roller skis if possible, or is it generally okay to do it running?
No, that's a really good question and an relevant aspect of this. So I would say it might be beneficial if you have both. You have kind of the general physiological capacities in running, and then you have more the specific physiological capacities in specific mode roller skiing, and kind of of course, it differs across individual skiers, but on average, they reach a higher V2 max, or at least historically, higher V2 max in running, and maybe even a bit higher in the diagonal sub technique in classical skiing uphill, because then you also have, you're using your upper body together with the lower body. And then you are at least on average a bit lower in kind of the skating style sub techniques and the bubble pulling sub technique in the classical style. So then this relationship between view to peak obtained in different sub techniques and view to max obtained in the mode that you reach your view to max, either if it's running or diagonal, it's kind of a demand of the sport to try to close the gap between the view to peak in, for example, skating sub techniques. Close the gap between view to peak in skating sub techniques and view to max in running, for example. Mm. So if you only reach 85 or 90% of your view to max in a skating sub technique, there that might have some implications for your training, that you need to perform more specific training in that mode to like close that gap. But for other skiers, it might also be different, that they reach the same VO2 values in skating sub techniques as in diagonal sub technique or in running, and some maybe also reach higher values in skating sub techniques. And some of these long distance skiers that are really adapted their upper body to double poling, they can reach a higher VO2 values in double poling than in running, for example. So there's some individual differences there, but it's on average, I think most reach higher V2 values in running or diagonal compared to double poling and some of the skating sub techniques. And it's a demand to kind of close that gap, I would say, and it has some possible implications for your training.
Mm, interesting. And in terms of training prescription for the lactate profiling, for example, when you go out and train in the tracks, you have terrain, you have different friction and so on. So speed is not really a good metric necessarily of the internal intensity. But do the skiers use a lot of heart rate to do the training in at the prescribed intensity, or do they rely a lot on RPE? How does that work?
Yeah. That's a relevant aspect, that in cross-country skiing, you don't have kind of a good measure of the external intensity. And it differs kind of the speed, as you say, depending on the course profile and the weather conditions. And if it's in skiing, it depends on kind of the snow and snow friction and everything. So you need to base your intensity control more on internal measures. And what is most commonly used, I would say, is heart rate in combination with their feeling or the rate of perceived exhaustion during training to kind of intensity steer their training, depending on the goal of the session. And at the same time, we also see a tendency towards more and more use of low lactate measurements in cross-country skiing as well, probably inspired by middle and long distance running and triathlon, kind of these training models or philosophies. So yeah, that's kind of the what makes cross-country skiing complex, is that you don't have these external intensity measures, and you need to rely on internal intensity measures, and then it's that might come with some challenges. So it's, I guess you can argue that it's even more important in cross-country skiing to perform standardized sessions, blood lactate profiles in the lab under standardized conditions to kind of measure measure and monitor your adaptations and how you're responding to training, because there are challenges with measuring it outside in the field in a valid manner.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, even more so probably than in cycling, old school cycling, you could at least use a climb and just do see how fast you go up that climb. But in there are so many more variables that change more with the weather conditions, the snow friction and so on in cross country skiing. So that makes sense. Now, can you describe, there's probably no such thing as a typical, but an example training week of a cross-country skier, because I think a lot of listeners would be interested in hearing a little bit more, because we are all so familiar with hearing what elite triathletes do, but what about other endurance sports? So if you can just give an example of what it might look like.
Yeah, no, as within all endurance sports, there are, of course, differences across teams, groups, and individual athletes. But I would say if a typical training week for cross-country skiing in Norway is maybe somewhere between 10 and 12 training sessions, 20 to 30 training hours, 2 to 3 of those sessions at moderate intensity, threshold intensity, or high intensity, maybe depending on their intensity distribution model and where in the annual training cycle they are. Maybe 2 strength sessions, although the strength training prioritization between cross-country skiers differ a lot. 2 speed sessions, maybe not as kind of full sessions, but integrated into low intensity training sessions with some speed. Some sections focusing on speed there. I think that summarizes kind of a typical training week. And they emphasize on volume, low intensity training, and maybe also threshold training and moderate intensity training is higher typically in the general preparation period in the kind of the spring and the summer. And then in the specific preparation period in the autumn before the winter or the season starts, it's maybe a change towards some sessions with higher intensity. So kind of a small intensification with some more sessions and volume at high intensity. But I also think there's been a trend or a tendency in cross-country skiing last years to train a bit more, like on average, higher volumes, more low intensity training, and also more and higher volumes and moderate intensity training, so threshold training and more training sessions at a controlled or interval sessions at a controlled intensity.
Mm. What about the distribution of volume within sessions? Is it quite steady that they do a lot of, let's say, sessions that are around 2 hours, 1.5, 2 hours, or is there a large variation that there are a couple of 3 hour sessions in a week, 3.5 hours, and then there are some shorter sessions, 1 hour? What does that look like?
It's a combination. There's some kind of shorter, low intensity sessions, but there's long traditions in cross-country skiing, at least in Norway, to have kind of a 3 hour long duration, low intensity session per week. And so maybe at least on the elite level have 2, maybe 3 of these 3 hour sessions. And I also know that some skiers like to emphasize their high intensity training or moderate intensity training and strength training at the same days. And then they can have kind of days in between with only emphasize on volume and low intensity training. And then they often have 5 hours in total. So typically 3 hours session in the morning running. And then they have a 2 hour session in the afternoon, double poling, for example, because then they kind of vary the mode that they use and load the lower body in the first session of the day and load the upper body more in the second session of the day. And thereby you might kind of increase your tolerance of a higher total training volume when you have variation in the mode, exercise mode.
Yeah, not too dissimilar from triathlon in that sense.
Exactly.
I I did hear that, I'm not sure if it's true, but I did hear that Andrew Musgrave, not Norwegian, but lives and trains in Norway, that he took those 3-hour sessions on skis, made them 4 hours, but then he also translated that into his summer training to 4-hour runs, so that he used to go out for 4-hour runs. I'm not sure if that's true, but that was quite interesting to hear, because for a lot of runners, it's 2 hours maximum, 2.5 hours is probably what you would do, and 2.5 would be in the really final preparation for a marathon. And but yeah, he took that a bit to the extreme. So is that something that you see in summer, that they do keep those long runs in, not 4 hours necessarily, but that they basically translate the skiing in some way to running, of course also roller skiing?
Yeah, the proportion of running in kind of the preparation period in cross-country skiing can be quite high in cross-country skiers. So they run a lot, and they often run longer sessions, as you say, than kind of what runners do. So they can run, at least in the summer, they can have like most stop 3 hours, I would say, but some have also some sessions that are longer, maybe 4 or 5 hours running in the kind of the mountains, or in they don't run kind of on the road and asphalt, mm-hmm. but they run in the forest and in the marshland, kind of in soft terrain. That is kind of long traditions for doing that in cross-country skiing, both in Norway and Sweden and Finland, I think. So as a method to tolerate higher volumes of running, they run in those terrains. So it's interesting and kind of just demonstrates the different traditions between different endurance sports.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, that each endurance sport seems to have their own traditions, their own best practices. And what would you say, from your knowledge about cross-country skiing compared to other endurance sports like running and cycling, are there any other differences that you would that comes to mind that you would highlight?
Yeah, sure. Cross-country skiing is, as we said, a kind of complex sport with a lot of different demands. But the most important difference compared to running cycling, which typically has a more stable intensity and speed, there are kind of constant changes in the incline due to the course profile in cross-country skiing, and a constant change in speed and change sub techniques that they change between within the two different styles, like the skating style and the classical style. And also within the different sub techniques, you also have kind of differences in how you adapt your cycle length and cycle rate. So there's kind of a complexity with regards to these changes in sub techniques and or gears. This also kind of provides a complexity in the exercise intensity and the energy turnover, because in the uphill sections, for example, in the race course, you have a much higher intensity, and you often have an external intensity that is higher than your kind of mutual max, and thus you have an anaerobic energy contribution in the uphill sections. And then you have a subsequent downhill sections where you kind of need to recover again and restore these anaerobic energy systems to be able to kind of perform the next section in the course again at the same intensity. So you have an intensity in the upper sections that is above your VO2 max, and you have kind of these small anaerobic energy contributions that you need to recover from, that is unique to cross-country skiing and of course the biathlon and Nordic combined, the skiing there, which make it a bit different and has contributes to different demands compared to running, for example. I think you can see the same in kind of trail cycling, or where you have constant changes in terrain, if that's the right sport.
Yeah, in cycling in general, I think also in road cycling with the way that the races are laid out, so it depends. That depends hugely on the course profile, but even on flat races, you have potentially sections with crosswinds and so on, and you might have people that aim for the tactics play a part there. So I think cycling is a good comparison probably to cross country skiing. You have a very general question here to finish off before some listener questions. If you could give three pieces of advice to amateur endurance athletes, whether they be triathletes or cross-country skiers or anything, what would you say?
I would start with saying that training is simple, and it should be kept that way. Historically, there's been a lot of different training methods and models that have shown to work, and some of the most successful endurance athletes have done things really simple in some cases. And if you compare that to what many kind of recreational and amateur athletes do today, I think that's a good place to start. You need to keep things simple and understandable, but at the same time, kind of the mechanisms behind and the science and the physiology and the different things that we have discussed now, they might be complex. But you need to kind of take out the most essential parts and do things that are simple and understandable. And if you do that over time, it works. That's my first point. My second point is that I think many recreational athletes, amateur athletes, they train too hard in a way. So they don't get any results or adaptations from their endurance training because they train too hard. In many cases, they train too much compared to kind of all the other stress loads that they have in their life. So kind of the load recovery balance is too high. And they take too high risk in their training compared to the benefits that they get out of their training. So if you're going to adapt to training, you need to have kind of the available resources to make that adaptation to happen. And if you're fatigued constantly, that won't happen. You will just become better at being fatigued in a way. So finding a more appropriate load recovery balance, and also to do more of your training and a controlled intensity. Often these recreational athletes, at least what I have experienced, they train too hard on their high intensity sessions and they use long time to recover. But if you kind of reduce your intensity a bit, train more threshold maybe and a bit higher volume, you will get the same or maybe better adaptations, and you don't need the same time for recovery. So you will have a better consistency, I think, in your training if you take the load but also the intensity a bit down on your training. That's my second point. And the third point is that I think many amateur athletes, they have something to gain from distributing the energy better, so pacing better in competitions, particularly in running. They often open too hard and hit the wall, and they lose a lot of time in the last half of their competition or last third part of their competition compared to what they would have kind of been able to do with a more kind of even pace or conservative pace. This is both in competitions but also during training sessions, that you shouldn't perform the first one or two stages of your interval session too fast at too high intensity. You should kind of be able to have the same speed or power at the last stage of your interval, and maybe also progression in speed or power during your interval session. So yeah, it was a long answer, but to summarize, keep things simple. Training is simple. And two, don't train too hard. And three, try to look at your pacing during training and especially during competitions.
Yeah, excellent, excellent points. And we have a couple more listener questions. The first one is from Oscar, who asks, are there differences in training for women and men? And could this have anything to do with the success of the Norwegian men, but not women, and Swedish women, but not men in cross-country skiing at the moment?
That was a tough question. Can try to answer briefly. There are, of course, female specific aspects that might influence the training process and adaptations, but I don't think, based on the current literature, that there are kind of consensus enough to provide different training prescriptions for male compared to female athletes. When it comes to cross-country skiers in Norway versus Sweden, it's a bit hard to answer. I don't have kind of all the insights there to have some clear opinions, especially not in Sweden, although I would like to hear what the Swedish female skiers are doing in their training, especially the sprint skiers. But yeah, I think of course in Norway there are more male skiers, so maybe the female side is a bit more vulnerable in a way. And over the last years, there's some of the best Norwegian female skiers, they have retired. So it's kind of a gap there. Although the last season on the female side in Norway was quite good. This year has been a little bit less good, maybe. And some of them have also kind of said in media that they have struggled a bit with the load recovery balance. And also it was kind of this evaluation report of the female cross-country skiing in Norway in 2022 on initiative from the Ski Federation. And there they made some suggestions for actions to be taken to improve the kind of the number of female skiers and the performance level in Norway. And that was kind of developed kind of the culture on training in different places in Norway and try to keep more female skiers to continue their career longer and also have kind of maybe better control systems for their quality ensuring of their training and performance development. And I think many of these actions have been the different actions that were suggested have been implemented in Norway, maybe, but it takes time to kind of see the effects on them. So that might be some of the reasons, but what the reasons are, it's hard to say. And when it comes to Sweden, I don't have good enough insight. Maybe it's a bit of the same there, but on the male side, I don't know. Yeah,
I mean, I think just about the difference between the Norwegian men and Swedish men, Norwegian women, Swedish women. It's a lot of these things are just a bit coincidence as well. Like, when do you happen to get that next star? You see the same thing in triathlon, that of a few five to 10 years ago when the Brownlee brothers in the UK were big, then of course the British women were also good, but the men were dominating. And now they still have Alexi. That's maybe a bad example, but it comes and goes a bit in waves. And I think both, at least in terms of Norway and Sweden, from a very outside perspective from me, I think that that it's more coincidence than anything. But that's not to say that there aren't the differences in training between men and women, of course. But I'm not sure that the current, as you said, it wasn't that many years ago or long ago that Norway had some super strong women as well. So, and they just happened to retire recently.
Yeah, good point. There's a random kind of element or factor to it as well. It's important to be aware of, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and Sweden used to have some really amazing men as well. But the final listener question is from Gary. Should training methods be transferred across endurance sports the way they are? I think that what he means is basically, Can a cyclist or a triathlete take the cross-country skiing methods, or can a cross-country skier take running training methods and so on? That's what he's getting at.
Yeah. I think many training methods, philosophies, and principles are relevant across sports, and that you can get inspiration and learn from different sports, and think that there exists cases where that have happened. On the other hand, I think your training needs to be kind of sport specific enough. It's an important aspect of training and maximizing your performance is to have good knowledge about the sport specific demands or the demands of your sport, and kind of do training that targets those sport-specific demands or limiting factors. So I would say it's a combination. You can learn from across sports and adapt methods across sport, but you need to keep in mind that the sport-specific demands and what is the limitations of performance in your sport.
Yeah, no, perfect. And finally, let's finish off with the rapid-fire questions. So take just one sentence to answer each of these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to endurance sport?
Yeah, I can't come up with a book, but I look forward to reading this the latest book of Inigo Muica on endurance training. I haven't read that one, so I should probably do that, or I look forward to do that. But mostly I kind of adapt my knowledge from scientific articles, reading the available literature, but also, of course, through discussions and talking with the practitioners, a lot of coaches, athletes. So it's a combination of kind of reading the research literature and also talking with athletes and coaches.
Mm. And what's an important habit that you've benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
It's probably a lot of different things, I would say. But if I should say one thing, I would say consistency. Consistency is the thing that matters the most, either if it's endurance training and becoming kind of an Olympic champion in an endurance sport, or it's work or kind of doing a PhD or whatever. It's like showing up every day, doing the work. Consistency is kind of the key to everything. And a lot of athletes and people are able to kind of provide full effort for 1 week, either with training or with work. But that type of kind of forcing often backfires. So it's about taking small steps every day and find the right load recovery balance, as I said many times now, both in training but also in life in general, to kind of ensure this consistency. So I think, I read somewhere once that if you plan to go hard or go home, you often end up going home. So, yeah, I think it's correctness in that.
Yeah, no, that's good. And who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
I think that's a lot of persons, but of course, my supervisor during my bachelor, master's, and PhD, and also a mentor and good friend is Eivind Sandbach. He's kind of the professor and leader of our research group at NTNU in Trondheim. And in addition to him, there's been kind of many practitioners and colleagues that I've both coaches that I've worked with, but also other colleagues more in research. So I think it's hard to say some more names because then I will forget someone, but of course I wouldn't have been doing the things I do today and had the job I have today if it hasn't been for Eivind, which has been kind of my mentor over the last 10 years.
Yeah, that's great. Eivind is a past guest on the podcast as well, so I will link to that in the show notes. And yeah, thank you so much for this, Rune. It was great to chat with you. Lots of really, really interesting things came up. Where can people follow you and find you?
Yeah, I try to upload my research to kind of ResearchGate and this type of things for those that are kind of really into research. But you could probably also find me on Twitter or X. It's the correct term now, although I don't post that much and take part in conversations there. But if I have some kind of new articles that I want to share, I often share those there. So yeah, that could be a possibility.
Great. Yeah, thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation. Hope to do it again another time.
Thank you. No problem. It was a really, really nice conversation, and I'm glad that you invited me to talk in your podcast.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. And I have a number of links there, including, of course, Dune's Twitter and ResearchGate. But some of the specific studies that we discussed in this interview, including the return from underperformance to world-class level case study, as well as the two papers related to the discussion around training progression in terms of volume or intensity. And also, we mentioned Eivind Sandbach, past guest on the podcast. Of course, go and listen to that episode if you're interested. That was a really good discussion around distance running and the training characteristics of world-class distance runners. And I also have a previous, more cross-country skiing related episode back in episode 245 with Erik Myhrd Nossum, also Norwegian. So that's also well worth a listen if you're interested in cross-country skiing in particular. Some personal takeaways from me is, first of all, overtraining is a spectrum, and clinically it is diagnosed after the fact based on how long it takes to regain regular performance capacity. So if it's measured in a couple of months or more, then we're looking at more of an overtraining syndrome rather than just non-functional overreaching without there being a super hard, hard and fast border there between overtraining syndrome and non-functional overreaching. It is a spectrum. So it is hard to diagnose. You don't have any very clear blood markers, or not a lot of them, that you can look at, or any very clear and very reliable diagnostic tests that are practically feasible to do outside of a very resource-rich environment. But the good thing, I guess, in terms of classifying things, it doesn't really matter if you are technically overtrained or technically just non-functionally overreached, because even if you just need to rest for a week to regain your performance capacity, that is basically a week of lost training opportunity, where not having had stress levels in balance led to loss of consistency. So here I use the term stress levels rather than training load deliberately, because as we discussed, overtraining is maybe not even the best term, as it is so multifactorial, where things like life stress, sleep and recovery, nutrition, etc. play a huge role. So the takeaway number one here is try to just not put yourself in a position in the first place where you even have to wonder about whether you're overtrained or just overreached, because both are pretty bad, and you don't really want to experience either of them. When I interviewed Jim Vance some time ago, we talked about the thing that he calls the two-day rule. And the point of that rule is that you should be able to take two very light days of training, maybe even a complete rest day in there, and then perform very near to your best, if not at your best. So that's, I think, a pretty good rule of thumb that most of us can apply in our day-to-day training in order to prevent problems like this from occurring. Of course, we have to be a little bit contextual, so I don't think this needs to be 100% true 100% of the time, but I do very much agree with the philosophy behind this rule. And then if it's maybe every once in a while that you need 3 days in terms of heavy load or in times of heavy load to get back to your best, so be it. But the point is that it should be more like a 2 to 4 day rule rather than a 2 to 4 week rule, because then you're already pushing too much and getting into that unsustainable realm. And secondly, still on the topic of overtraining, we discussed how monitoring the external and internal markers of stress during exercise and how they relate is one of the best ways of monitoring whether you're entering overreaching territory. So basically, you would measure an external measure of intensity like power or pace, and an internal measure of, or actually both internal measures of intensity, heart rate and RPE for all of your training, and learn how these internal and external measures relate to one another. So if heart rate is lower for the same power or pace, but RPE is the same, or especially if RPE is higher, so you're working harder, then that's a very clear sign that you're entering overreaching territory. It doesn't mean necessarily that it's non-functional overreaching, so maybe just a day or two of rest can set it right. It certainly doesn't mean overtraining syndrome, but if you notice these trends, then it's time to pay attention and consider whether it would make sense to take a bit of recovery or deloading your program a bit. And then the final personal takeaway from me is regarding Rune's research in progressing intensity or volume. I think that this is another great example of how there are many ways to skin a cat. And if we really zoom out, the overall load, as long as the stress is balanced and not out of balance, leading to non-functional overreaching, that overall load is probably much more important than the details of how that load is composed. So, of course, for the individual athlete, there may be situations where one or the other is more likely to be effective, as we saw in some of the individual responses. And this is why being very engaged in your training process and monitoring how your performance is trending is important. But it's also why, unless you're working with a coach who's helping you figure out what really works for you, I would actually recommend diversifying your training and not putting all your eggs in one basket with any given training methodology. So, and to be fair, even as a coach, this is something that I do, because you can never be 100% sure what will work for an athlete. So basically, you end up using a variety of different, let's call it, training blocks within your periodization, so that even if you end up not responding well to one of them, you are maybe more likely to respond better to some of the others. So imagine, hypothetically, you could use both of these blocks of intensifying versus increasing volume that was used in the research, and maybe you're not a responder to one of them, but you are a responder to the other, so you still see an overall improvement. So that's something that I would recommend for a lot of self-coach athletes, to basically not putting all your eggs in one basket, diversifying your training. This is certainly the philosophy that I have in things like the ready-made training plans that are available for purchase on scientifictriathlon.com, to make sure that as many athletes as possible are likely to benefit from them, because there are various different blocks of training that might, you might not respond to every single block, but you are very likely to respond to quite a few of them, because it's just varied and diversified. So that is it for my personal takeaways. I have a little request. I came across some other podcast recently talking about how now the algorithms for the podcast platforms are again putting a lot of stock and emphasis into new ratings and reviews for podcasts. So if that is a thing, which I assume that is correct, not that I have verified, then I would really appreciate if some listeners that have not yet rated and reviewed that Triathlon Show, if you could rate and review it on whatever your preferred podcast platform is. But especially the really big ones are Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So those are probably the most important ones, but any platform that you're using, it would be appreciated. And don't forget that on scientifictriathlon.com, we're offering coaching, training plans, and consultations. You can check out all of those options, including pricing, on scientifictriathlon.com. I'm going to unapologetically try to be a bit better at marketing these services, because that's the main thing that I do and the main thing that we do at Scientific Triathlon. So I want to read an example of a review that we got from one of our coached athletes. And this is in response to a question in a feedback form that we have. And the question is around what their expectations were when they signed up and if they had been met or not as being a coached athlete. And they wrote, quote, "My expectations when signing up was to invest in a coach who would be able to give specific training for me as an athlete, someone who I could openly communicate with and learn from in the long run and get advice on things such as racing. Also for me, the communication aspect was very important, whether it be feedback on sessions or adaptability of programs. My my expectations were definitely met and went beyond. I felt I was able to have a great athlete-coach relationship and I could trust in my coach with his training structure, and this was down to great knowledge on his side and professionalism, end quote. So yeah, if you want great professional coaching with great coach-athlete relationships and individualized programming for just for you, that is what we specialize in. So check out scientifictriathlon.com and the information we have about coaching services there, and feel free to reach out and ask for more information. In the next episode of the podcast, I interview Tomek Kowalski. He is a coach from Poland, and he's also an academic currently working on science related to respiratory muscle training. So this is probably something that most listeners may not know much about, and that goes for myself as well, to be honest. I know a tiny bit, but I have already conducted this interview, and I can say that this is a really interesting topic and well worth tuning in into for those insight. And in the coaching part as well, Tomek is somebody that has coached several athletes that have won their age groups in Kona, and lots of athletes that have raced at a very high age group level. So we kind of, the coaching discussion that we also have is related to, especially to really high performance age groupers, let's say, but we also have some more general time crunched age group questions. But to be fair, even those high performance age groupers, I can reveal a bit of a teaser, but those Kona winning age groupers that Tomek was working with, we're training on average 13 to 14 hours per week. So it's, of course, it's an average. So there are weeks that are significantly bigger than that, but it's not crazy volume that they're doing. So so yeah, if you want to hear more about that, tune into the next episode, which will be released when it will be released. Finally, to finish off this episode, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure that you try Precision Fuel and Hydration. There are a range of options from drink mix to gels to choose, so you can easily find your personal favorite. Don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS24. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Swim Trainer is a great tool to have in your toolbox to improve your technique and power, to target specific aspects of your stroke, and to maintain consistency when you don't have time to get to the pool. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.